Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with the phone line open for you to call if you have questions about the Bible, questions about the Christian life, Christian theology, Christian ethics, Christian history, Christian apologetics, all that kind of stuff. If you disagree with the host on something you've heard here, you're welcome to call about that too, and we'll discuss it together on the air. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Before we go to the phone lines, I just want to mention that every day, usually I go for a fairly long walk, and I listen to audiobooks or something edifying. And lately, I've been listening to a book that I read a couple or three times when I was younger, back in the 70s, actually, when I was in my 20s. I discovered works by William Law. Now, many of you never will have heard of him. Those of you who have are probably delighted to hear his name, because anyone who's read his works knows the superiority of his work. He wrote back in the 1720s. He wrote a book called Christian Perfection around 1726, and one called A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life in 1729. Now, William Law was a tremendous influence on John and Charles Wesley, who were the main, along with George Whitefield, were the main leaders of the evangelical revival in England, which was a huge revival. And historians pretty much say that this book, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life, was, if any book could be, you could trace it back, the revival back to this book. Now, again, he was an early mentor to the Wesleys, although they did distance themselves from him later in life, and he did, in his later life, take some controversial views, some of which I don't find offensive, but some people do. But anyway, I discovered this guy when I was in my 20s. And I read both Christian Perfection and A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life multiple times, at least twice or three times with The Serious Call. And since Christian Perfection is a shorter book, I probably read it perhaps maybe more times than that. However, it's been decades since I read them. They definitely shaped my thinking back in my 20s, and I can see as I listen to it on audiobook now, some decades later, some of the areas where my thinking was shaped by this book. And I really just want to say, some of you, you know, wonder if there's any good books out there. A lot of the better books, I think, were written a long time ago. There are, I believe, some books written recently that are good, but the really good ones from a long time ago that you can still get are usually available only because they are really good. I mean, usually books don't stay in print for 300, 400 years unless they really have merit. And William Law, that's L-A-W, I think his name might put some people off. He's a fairly strict Anglican type of guy, but he's more of a radical discipleship kind of a guy. But some people might think of him, maybe partly because his name is Law, as legalistic. I don't find him overly legalistic. I do find him holding a high standard, which is no less than what I find Jesus and the apostles doing. But anyway, if you're looking for something that's really challenging, I will say this. I don't agree with everything he says. His book is a little archaic in some ways, but it's charming that way. I mean, it has different culture in England in the 1700s than we have here. But the principles in the book are definitely powerful, and he is one of the best writers of his age. Fantastic writers. It's delightful. He's a, you know, there's humor kind of wry humor kind of woven in, but he's a serious writer. And again, if you're wondering and you're looking for it, you can get this in audiobook or hard copy. And by the way, I don't sell books, so I'm not offering this book for sale. You can go wherever you buy books and get it. The name of the author is William Law, and the book is called A Serious Call. Sometimes they just call it that because the title is so long, but the whole name is A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. If you can get that book, and I think you can, it's available most places where books are sold online, I think you'll find it very challenging. And if you're looking for something that's not you know, just repeating the spirit of this present evangelical age, and you'd like something that's a little more radical from centuries ago, that's still timely, that's what I would suggest. Again, read with discretion because, you know, there's no author who is right about everything. And I don't agree with everything William Law teaches, but the overall effect of his writings is extremely positive in terms of elevating your understanding of Christian life. And again, he's not talking theology. He's talking about radical discipleship. And a guy writing in the 1700s about that is refreshing to find. Okay, let's go to the phones and talk to Jacob from Puyallup, Washington. Jacob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. This could be included in thoughts about if we are a part of Israel. Does the Bible say that we should bless Israel? Should we bless Israel today? And if so, or if you can say yes, what does this involve?
Well, blessing Israel is an Old Testament concept. Israel was God's holy people. They were set apart among all the nations and a chosen race of people, unlike any Gentile nations. And God had an earthly plan for Israel. That's why he created the nation. And that plan was to bring the Messiah into the world, which they did, almost against their wishes. They opposed the prophets, and they opposed the Messiah when he came, but nonetheless, God used that nation to bring the Messiah into the world, and now that Jesus has come, all nations stand pretty much in the same position as Israel, in the sense that all need to embrace the Messiah. Every person needs to, whether they're of Israel or of a Gentile background, doesn't really matter ethnicity. It's God judges people on the basis of their spiritual commitments, not their ancestry. Now, back when Israel, the nation, was uniquely God's people in the Old Testament times, there are some statements that indicate that, you know, it was incumbent on nations other than them to bless Israel, because if they would oppose themselves to Israel, they'd be opposing themselves to God's holy nation, and they would themselves forfeit blessing upon their nations. So the statement about blessing Israel originally was made to Abraham, about blessing him. In Genesis 12, God told him that whoever blesses you, I will bless, and whoever curses you, I will curse. Now, this is technically a statement about Abraham himself and God's favoring Abraham and having his back. You know, if people attack Abraham, God will attack them. If people are good to Abraham, that'll go well for them. That's what blessing and cursing means. And later on, you find the same statement made by Balaam somewhere in the book of Numbers. Balaam is talking about Israel and says, blessed is he who blesses Israel, and cursed is he who curses him, which is, of course, repeating the words that were spoken to Abraham. So today, there are people who say that Christians should be blessing Israel, but it's not clear how they mean that. What do they mean by Israel? Are they talking about this political entity that is in the spot on the globe where ancient Israel was? And if so, why would we assume that the blessing on Israel that applied to them when they were God's chosen nation would apply to them when they have now rejected the Messiah and in most cases have refused to become part of God's new chosen nation, which is the body of Christ, the Messiah's people? There's no blessing on those who are not the Messiah's people. I mean, except for whatever general blessings may come on mankind just because God is good. I mean, Jesus said God is gracious. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends his rain on the just and the unjust. So all people receive some blessing from God just because God is magnanimous. But in terms of special blessing, like blessing one nation more than another nation for some reason, well, I can't think of any reason why God would bless a nation that isn't particularly open to him. For example, the nation of Israel today in the Middle East is primarily, you know, the citizenry are mostly unbelievers. There are some of them who are Orthodox Jews, but by definition, Orthodox Jews are unbelievers in the Messiah. Orthodox Jews follow Talmudism, and the Talmud rejects Christ as Messiah and calls him an illegitimate bastard and a sorcerer. This is what the Talmud says about Jesus. So why would people who hold to that religion have any special blessing from God? probably more Jews on the earth that are atheists than are of any other particular belief. There are different kinds of Jewish observant Jews. I mean, Orthodox being the only one that comes close to a biblical kind of Judaism. But there's Reformed Jews and there's Conservative Judaism. But and then there's just secular Jews. Most Jews are secular. And even if they weren't, the nation of Israel is secular. The nation of Israel is not a religious nation. It doesn't have, it's not controlled by religious people or even believers. Now, more than that, a very, very tiny part of the population of the nation of Israel believe in the Messiah. I think it's less than 3% believe in the Messiah. That means it's more anti-Christian than most nations are. I think you might find that many believing in Jesus in some of the Arab nations and some of the Muslim nations, if not more. And some of the pagan nations, the secular nations today, have much more than 3% who believe in Jesus. So Israel is one of the most unbelieving nations, if believing means believing in the Messiah. Now, is there a blessing on a nation that rejects the Messiah? I don't think so. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 16:22, if anyone does not love the Lord Jesus Messiah, let him be accursed. So now Paul's not picking out any particular race of people to curse. He's just saying anyone who doesn't receive Christ, who doesn't love Jesus, let them be accursed. Now, of course, that would mean at least, 97% of the population of Israel would be under that curse, as would be most of the people in Asia and Europe and North America and Africa. Most people don't love Jesus, and so that curse would be upon them. But I don't know of anything in the New Testament that would suggest that people can be despisers of Jesus Christ and also under God's blessing. How could that be? I can't see any reason to argue for that particular position. Thank you for your call, though. Our next caller is Tom from Jacksonville, Florida. Tom, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve, thank you so much for taking my call. I listen to you every day or 5 days a week, and it's really refreshing because it's obvious that you have studied Scripture for a long, long time. But I would like to ask you a question. I heard I drive a big truck locally, and I heard John MacArthur was saying that people that in heaven either don't care or don't know what's going on earth. And I've always read, you know, about Abraham and Lazarus and the rich man. And the rich man asked him, you know, send Lazarus over and let him stick his finger in water and cool my tongue. And so that leads me to believe that they do know in heaven, they do know what's going on earth, because technology will be unlimited. I can't believe that if you were going to look at a divine telescope and see what's going on earth, that Jesus would say, hey, leave that thing alone. You don't know what you're doing. And
The story of Lazarus and the rich man does suggest that the rich man knew something about things on earth, but all he knew, at least the only knowledge of things on earth that's recorded that he knew, was that he had five brothers who had not died yet. In other words, he knew he had died before his brothers did. That doesn't mean he could see what they were doing or had any specific knowledge of their activities. He was one of six sons, and he died first, and he knew that there were five others who had not died, and that was the only knowledge of earthly events that he gave any information about. As far as technology and so forth, you know, I don't think heaven depends on technology, but I will say this, that if people in heaven are not able to know what's going on earth, it's not for lack of technology or it's not for lack of access to that information. I think it'd be for lack of interest. But I don't know. I don't know if they have an interest or not. We don't know much of anything about people in heaven.
That's what John MacArthur said. They won't have any interest in what's going on here.
Well, you know, it does say in Hebrews 12:1 that we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, and therefore we should run the race with diligence. Now, but the statement we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses has been interpreted two different ways. One is that witnesses means spectators. And he has just finished chapter 11 of Hebrews, listing all the people of faith who have died in faith. And then he says, thus we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses, and therefore let's run the race well. It makes it kind of sound like he sees all these people who died in faith as spectators. I mean, it's like we're at a sporting event where people are running their races sequentially, and the ones who have finished their races have taken their place in the stands to watch those who are still running their races. That is at least an image that has often been drawn from this statement about the cloud of witnesses. On the other hand, there is another way of seeing it, and I don't know which the correct way is, but another way of seeing it is that witnesses doesn't mean spectators. Witnesses means people who give testimony in court. In court, you call witnesses to testify to the truthfulness of some particular proposition or you know, side of a debate. And the witnesses are there to assure you that certain things have happened that they know of and they've seen. Now, a cloud of witnesses, therefore, may simply be saying that as every thing in the Old Testament had to be established in the mouth of two or more witnesses, well, we have a great cloud of witnesses. We have a great host of witnesses, the people of the Old Testament who died in faith and were rewarded for their faith. These people are bearing witness all to the same thing, namely, that the life of faith is what God approves of and what God rewards. And therefore, one could say that this cloud of witnesses is not referring to spectators in the stands who are watching us, which is one way of understanding it, but it could just mean that their lives bear testimony. They are witnesses, as it were, to us that the life of faith is the life that God will honor. And so the writer of Hebrews may be making one point or the other. It's not clear which one. It seems to me, though, that if it is the first of these interpretations, then it would give support to the idea that people who have died in faith and are now in heaven are able to see us and watch us. On the other hand, I'm not sure that that's the right meaning of the word witness in that passage. And the only pictures of heaven we actually have in the Bible are from a couple of chapters of the book of Revelation. And there, although I think they're very symbolic, the impression one gets from them is that the saints are simply adoring Christ and God on the throne. They're bowing down, casting their crowns down, singing day and night around the clock, his praises and things like that. If that is true, of course, I do believe that Revelation is not written in literal terms, but the impression that it gives is that the focus of those who've died and gone to heaven is not on the earth or earthly activities, but rather on God himself. So I guess we have to leave that one unanswerable. John MacArthur is perhaps more sure of his position than I can be of mine or of either position, because I don't know. All right, let's talk to Gavin from Detroit, Michigan. Gavin, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. How are you doing, sir? I hope you're having a good day.
Yes, sir.
Okay, my question is, did God, Jesus Christ, our creator of the universe and all, did he start the religion Christianity? Or is Christianity a man-made religion like Baptist, Lutheran, Methodist, and Mormon?
Well, that's a good question. Did Jesus start the religion of Christianity? What I can say is that the word Christianity refers to a religion that claims to go back to, of course, Jesus Christ. However, many of the things in the Christian religion have no origins in anything Jesus said or did, or the apostles even. And so that does raise questions about it. The word Christianity is not found in the Bible. Okay, Christianity is a word that has been adopted somewhere since the time of Christ and the apostles to describe the religion that that recognizes Christ as the Messiah. And so those who are part of that religion are called members of Christianity. Now, the word Christian is found in the Bible, but it doesn't refer to members of a religion in particular. The word Christian is only found three times. One time, it's Agrippa saying, "Paul, you almost persuade me to become a Christian," which doesn't tell us very much about what he means by a Christian. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4, if you suffer for being a Christian, don't be ashamed. Again, he doesn't tell us what Christian means. He's using a word, as Agrippa is, that's already one that is known. But the only passage that tells us what a Christian is Acts 11:26, which says the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Now, the disciples are the ones who also bore the title Christians. We don't read of them starting a religion called Christianity, though we can see how the name Christianity was applied to that religion, since the believers and followers of Christ were called Christians. But but Jesus never really suggested anything about starting a religion. Jesus and his disciples lived at a time where there was already a religion that Jesus did not undermine, and that was the religion given to Moses, or to Israel through Moses. Now, Jesus did indicate he came to fulfill that, and we do know that Jesus made a new covenant which replaced the terms of the old covenant under which the religion of Judaism had been formed and defined. But we don't find Jesus, substituting it with another religion or even showing any interest in religion. Jesus, everywhere in his teaching, said he came to start a kingdom. Now, a kingdom is a society governed by a king. That's a very different thing than a religion. A religion is a group of people, who worship a deity, usually through certain rituals and certain habits and, things that are set aside for purposes only of worship, like holy places and holy orders of, men who are set apart for it and so forth. And, Jesus didn't set apart any places. Jesus didn't set apart any clergy that we know of. He did appoint the 12 apostles to, stand in for him after he left, but stand in for him as what? As leaders of a community. When we read of the actual activities of that community in the book of Acts, we don't read much about rituals or religion. We read that they studied under the apostles, so there was this academic aspect. They ate together. That's what people do when they're in a community, but not specifically a religious activity. They prayed, which might be considered to be a religion to those who don't really know God. If you know God, prayer is just conversation with him, you see. And they fellowshipped together. So the things they did, and they shared their goods. So it sounds like the society that Jesus set up had economic and educational and social aspects, and they were all serving another king named Jesus, as opposed to Caesar or some earthly king. Now, this is not the same thing as a religion, though prayer is mentioned there, and certainly people who are in religions do pray to their deities. However, Jesus taught us not to pray as a religious exercise. He said the heathen do that, and so did the Pharisees. He said don't pray like they do, and don't pray like the heathen do. He says, when you pray, just talk to your father. In other words, it's a family. He didn't act like this is a religious exercise. He acted like this was a communication between a child and his parent, more like a family exercise. So, one could argue that Jesus didn't start a religion. At least he never mentioned that he did and never intended to, as far as we know. What he started was, as he always said and as the apostles said, he started a kingdom. Or he reestablished a kingdom under himself, just like Israel had been a kingdom in the world under the rulership of God. So the disciples formed a kingdom under the leadership of Christ. Now, lots of religious things were added to it because people are almost terminally religious. People have a real hard time not being religious. And I think religion may elevate a person's spirit at certain times, depending on how good it is, how true it is. But really, a relationship with God through Christ is exactly what Jesus promoted Now, some people might say, well, a relationship with God, that's what a religion is. Well, that's not what I think of when I think of world religions. I don't think most world religions have a relationship with God. They might be seeking one. But Jesus actually brought us into the family of God by rebirth, by giving us the spirit of adoption, so that our approach to God is not a religious one, but a family one. He says, we cry, Abba, Father, like a child crying out to a father. It's very different. The Jews didn't do that, by the way. The Jews worshiped the same God, but they didn't call him Father. They worshiped him as an object of worship, and we do worship the Father, but we worship him as a father, not as a religious object. At least it may be just a matter of semantics to some people, but I don't see anything in the Bible saying that the Christian religion was started by Jesus, and certainly the things that became attached to it in the centuries after the apostles, most of them didn't have anything to do with Jesus' teachings either. So I hope that helps. All right. We're going to have to take a break here. We have another half hour coming up, so don't go away, folks. The Narrow Path is listener supported. If you'd like to help us stand there, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. There's free resources there galore, but there is also donation opportunity there at thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds, so don't go away.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. We're proud to welcome you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the archives of all the radio shows. Study, learn, and enjoy. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or disagree with the host and want to talk about that, feel free to call this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Max from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Max. Hey, I enjoy talking to you so much that we often go on quite long and crowd out a lot of other callers. I'd rather not have to do that. So we can take up some point. I don't know what's on your mind today, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I'll get right to it. Thanks for having me on. Happy Friday sure. to you and everybody out there in the audience. The Tower of Babel, most people in the audience are familiar with the narrative where they're building a tower. And God sees them building it and says, if they keep on like this, then they'll be able to accomplish anything they put their minds to. Mm-hmm. And so then God goes and confuses their language. And that's according to Genesis, the story anyways, that's how we get many languages on the earth. My question is, how do you account for the fact that we have taller buildings now than the Tower of Babel was? As well as for the fact that through technology, through naturalism, we've also been able to derive the capability to instantaneously translate, like through Google Translate, we're sort of moving towards being able to understand each other as though there's one language. And why would God, it almost sounds like he's afraid of humanity, like, oh, they can do too much, so we better go mess with them. That's my question for you, Steve.
Okay, that's great. That's a great question. First of all, the fact that God prevented them from completing the project of the Tower of Babel does not suggest that they would never, ever be a time when men build bigger towers than that, or when they can defeat, in some measure, linguistic barriers in communication. What his statement is, he says, if they do this thing, it says then, let's see how it's worded here. He says, you know, nothing can be withheld from them. Here it is in verse 6, Genesis 11, 6. Indeed, these people are one. They all have one language. This is what they begin to do now. Nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. will be withheld from them, apparently meaning by God. You know, if I don't withhold them from this activity, you know, what can I withhold them from doing? Now, the point here is God had told the family of Noah when they came off the ark, he specifically told them to be fruitful and multiply and to fill the earth, the same thing he had told Adam and Eve before. He now gave those same instructions to Noah. But it says in chapter 11 that after the flood, some generations later, they said to one another, verse 3, come and let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly, and come let us build a tower for ourselves, a city, and make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now, the project here was intending to thwart what God wanted them to do. He wanted them to spread out and fill the whole earth. He didn't want humanity to be all concentrated in one place, and for one good reason. It's easy for a tyrant to control everybody if they're all in one place. Paul actually mentions this in Acts chapter 17, where he says that God made all nations and determined the boundaries of their habitation so that they could seek after God and find him. And what he's saying, I think, is that if people are all concentrated under one dictatorial ruler, it's easy to keep people from seeking God if that ruler wants to stop it. However, if people are in lots of independent sovereign nations, then, you know, one ruler may lock down his own society, but he can't lock all of them down. I think what God's trying to prevent here is what they were trying to create. That is a one-world government. Now, he says, if this is allowed to take place, then what won't they be allowed to do? In other words, if I don't say no to this, you know, then I'm setting a precedent of enabling them to do what they want. And I, you know, how can I justify saying no to anything? If they're rebelling against me this soon after the flood, and I just turn a blind eye to it. It's like if a parent, lets a child disobey and doesn't intervene to discipline, well, then the parent loses credibility and becomes much more difficult to be a consistent disciplinarian. And I think God says nothing will be withheld from them. I think what he means by that is I won't be able to tell them not to do anything if I don't enforce my commands. Here they are violating my commands. If I don't enforce it, you know, then, you know, at what point do I enforce something? Where do I set the boundary? And so he steps up to actually confuse them so that they can't all work together on this project. And they are essentially forced to disband the project and to move out into different regions. And because of the linguistic differences, it does become impossible for one person to rule them all. Now, of course, there's no prediction in this that people will not, you know, learn other languages and become multilingual, or, you know, I mean, certainly in the time of Alexander the Great, Koine Greek became the language of all the different areas he conquered. He enforced that. And even though they had their own local languages and dialects, everyone knew Greek. So it was possible for everyone to communicate. That is everyone in the Greek Empire, not everyone in the planet, because there were people dispersed lots of places who didn't know Greek. In fact, in biblical times, even in Roman times, people who didn't speak Greek were called barbarians. That's, in fact, what a barbarian was, somebody who didn't speak Koine Greek. So there were people who didn't know Greek, but nonetheless, to a very large extent, Alexander did seemingly defeat the barriers of linguistic variation that were set up at Babel. Not completely, but the fact that people might, in time, be able to undo some of the restrictions that God has put upon the race. For example, people couldn't fly for most of human history, but now they can in airplanes and other ways. I mean, God didn't make people flying. We don't know if he made that as he never forbade them to. I mean, if God said, don't you ever fly, well, then it'd be a sin for us to fly. But although we don't have him verbally forbidding us to fly, he just made it kind of impossible for people to fly for a long time. However, people have learned to fly, and we don't necessarily have to see that as a bad thing. It just is, it's a progress into areas that God didn't initially allow human beings to know how to do. Although we can say that they did learn to do it because God made human beings creative, like himself, in his own image. And that it was, I believe, his desire for us to learn lots of technological things. So I don't think that he's saying here that I'm going to prevent them from building this tower because otherwise they can do anything and I feel threatened by that. No, I think what he's saying is this is like my kids are rebelling at an early stage. This is the first big rebellion after the flood. I could just let it go, but then where do I draw the line? I mean, how do I withhold any activity from them? How do I maintain my credibility and my authority? So I don't see this as something challenged by the fact that we now have apps that can translate languages for us or technology that can build big buildings. That's not really, I think, what was at issue here. I think the idea of thwarting an attempt to have all people in one locality so they could be governed by one man who was happened to be Nimrod, according to chapter 10 of Genesis. It says in chapter 10, verse 10, the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was Babel. So it appears that Nimrod wanted to have a one-world government, and he wanted this tower built to start probably a one-world religion. Most scholars think that this was to be what we call a ziggurat. They have found many ziggurats, archaeologists have, in the Middle East. And a ziggurat was an astrological observatory. And so some say the Tower of Babel was built to be a temple to the worship of the stars, and therefore a something that bound people together in a one religious center and kept them under the watchful eye of one ruler. So this could be the things that were at issue here. Not everything is told us in detail, and the words that you quoted there can be understood more than one way, but I've looked at those for many years and never seen it the way you're suggesting. I've never seen him saying, well, uh-oh, they might rise up and do everything I can do and overthrow me or something like that. I don't know. I don't see anything in his words that would compel us to think in those terms. Thank you for your call, though. Let's talk next to Sasha from Elk Grove, California. Sasha, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I am studying in Job, and I have two questions, and unfortunately I'm going to have to take them off the air, the answers.
Okay.
In Job, what were the angels and Satan presenting to the Lord? And when Satan answers God, when God asked him, where have you come from? Satan answered, roaming around on the earth. And my question is, where else would he have been than on the earth? And
where else would he have been?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
okay.
First.
And thank you.
Oh, sure. Sure. I'm glad to take that call. Well, first of all, the Bible, I should say Job, doesn't mention angels distinctly. It talks about the sons of God. Now, I will say this. Most evangelical Christians understand this to mean angels, and that could be indeed what it is referring to. I would not have any interest in deciding that they were not angels, but I would also have to say that we're not told that they are angels. The term sons of God can be used a number of ways in the Bible, including of Jesus, but of course it's not referring to him. It can refer to Christians. The Bible says, as many as received Christ, to them he gave the power to become sons of God. Or in 1 John 3, it says, beloved, now we are the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be, and so forth. So, I mean, we are sons of God. Israel, when they were obedient to God, in Hosea, are referred to as sons of God. And Isaiah said to God concerning Israel, he says, you are our father and we are your children. Now, that doesn't mean that he saw God as the father of individual Israelites, but of the nation as a whole. Israel is called God's firstborn son in Exodus when he threatens Pharaoh and says, if you don't let Israel go, that's my firstborn, I'll kill your firstborn. So we can see that son of God, sons of God, are terms used various ways. Even in Psalm 2, most scholars believe that the term, when God says, you are my son, he's referring to the king of Israel. Because kings were sometimes in the Middle East considered to be the sons of the deities that were of their national religions too. So when Job says the sons of God gathered together and presented themselves before the Lord and Satan was among them, we don't know who these sons of God were. Now there are those, especially followers of the teaching of Michael Heiser, who believe that there was a council of gods, which are really not much different than what most of us would call angels, because he doesn't believe there are real gods. He believed they were created beings, just like angels. but that they were, you know, given some kind of authority by God to be his counsel. And there is reference to the counsel of the gods in Psalm 82, verse 1. And they're also called sons of the Most High. But even that, it's questionable what that's referring to. The point is that the term sons of God is not necessarily a reference to angels. Now, it could be. It may be that the angels were gathered before God and Satan among them. Some people might say, well, this means Satan must have been an angel or a fallen angel at least. Well, it could be, but it wouldn't be necessary. I mean, Satan might have access to God on occasion when other beings besides him have access to God. There are some who think that the sons of God presenting themselves before the Lord is really a reference to godly people on earth coming together at a worship service. As, for example, when Christians, you know, gather together to worship God, they're presenting themselves before the Lord. But you know, there's too many flexible variables in this particular statement. But let's go with it. Let's go with it that these are angels. I think that's a decent suggestion. And it's again, it doesn't mean that Satan was an angel, but he was actually able to be among them. And he was there as what the Revelation chapter 12 refers to him as the accuser of the brethren. And he was there to accuse Job, obviously, before God. Now, God asked Satan where he'd been, and Satan said he'd been roaming through the earth, up and down through it. And God said, well, have you seen my servant Job? You said, where else would Satan be but wandering around through the earth? Well, he might be, as in this case, in the presence of God. Obviously, Satan could accuse the brethren before God until Jesus ascended into heaven, according to Revelation 12. Until Jesus ascended, Satan was the accuser of the brethren who accused them before God day and night. That doesn't mean he literally was there day and night and never anywhere else, because the Bible does talk about Satan as having some former rule over the earth. Now, Jesus said all authority in heaven and earth have been given to me when he rose from the dead. So Satan doesn't have any authority, but Satan has momentum on his side. He used to have authority over the sons of men because of sin. He's the one who had the power of death, it says in Hebrews 2:14. So, you know, Satan apparently had access to heaven and earth. And on earth, he is depicted as scouting around, looking at things, looking for someone to, you know, assess and accuse before God. And Job was the man that was so targeted in this particular case. We're not given a holistic picture of all the things that go on in heaven and earth in the Bible anywhere. And we don't really know any more about the situation than we read right up in these chapters, which you've already read. The only thing I would say is the angels presented before God may be what we're reading about, or maybe sons of God refers to something other than angels. But I think angels is probably the best theory. And Satan being among them simply tells us that Satan was capable of being among them and to make accusations before God of God's people. But he also had access to the earth. Apparently, he'd go about surveying the situation and looking for people to accuse and then bringing those accusations to God. Beyond that, we aren't told anything. And there are people who have tried to patch together very elaborate, you know, maps of heaven and earth and of the activities of angels and the devil and so forth. But they have to do so largely out of their imagination, because the Bible doesn't go into those kinds of details any more than what we've just discussed. So, you know, more than one theory, I suppose, could be entertained. I'm not sure if it would make a difference in the way we live. Milton from Fort Worth, Texas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I've got a question about the Psalm of David, 103. That's just one example of the thing about the concept of father.
Yep. This, yeah, like as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear.
Some people in, like David, the Psalm of David, 103, he sees like a as the Lord shows compassion and pitieth people as children, you know? So,
well, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, Psalm 103:13 says, as a father pities his children, so the Lord pities those who fear him.
Yeah. But now there's a prayer. Also, Jesus said to the disciples, the Lord's Prayer, which is actually the disciples' prayer. The Lord's Prayer is actually John chapter 16.
I understand.
But
the
disciples' prayer, he says, our Father who art in heaven.
Yep.
So apparently, I would say that some people in the Old Testament did know God as Father, not just David, but maybe Levites. Can you elaborate on this? Because we can't spend time going through the Bible helps looking up all the words that refer to Father. So maybe you
You know, it doesn't take long to go through the Bible and look up all the occurrences where God is spoken of as Father in the Old Testament. There's not very many. There is, as I mentioned, and as you mentioned, Psalm 103, it says that like a father pities his children, God pities those who fear him. So he's likened to a father. In another place, in Isaiah, he's likened to a mother. He said, can a mother forget her nursing child or fail to have compassion on it? Well, she might be able to, but God, he said, God says, I won't. I won't forget you. I've got more compassion toward you than even a mother has toward her baby. God can compare himself to different kinds of situations, but to actually call him the Father or to address him as Father is what you don't find in the Jewish practices until Jesus came along. Now, you mentioned Jesus said, when you pray, say, Our Father. Yeah, that's very much in keeping with the teaching of Jesus. That's one of the factors in Jesus' teaching that was radical. In the Sermon on the Mount, where that prayer is found in Matthew 5 through 7, I think in those three chapters, Jesus may refer to God as Father about, 17 times or something like that. That's a pretty thick usage of the word Father in the teaching of Jesus and throughout the rest of his teaching. One of the main things Jesus came to do is to restore prodigal sons to a proper relationship with their father, which is God. But this idea that God is our Father and that we can speak to him as Abba, Father, Abba meaning daddy, is something that is not found in the Old Testament. Yes, Isaiah did say, God, you are our Father and we are your children. Collectively, Israel is seen as God's children. And that's also what David is saying in Psalm 103. Like a father pities his children, plural, so God pities those who fear him. He's thinking of the faithful in Israel. Of course, that could be brought down to the individual level, and that's fine. I wouldn't have any objection to that. But you don't really have God being addressed as Father in the Old Testament. That's not a name or title for God that was adopted by the Jews in Old Testament times. Okay, we'll talk to Al from British Columbia. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Al.
In the Old Testament, that's not a name.
You have to turn your radio down.
That was adopted by the Jews.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Times.
No, you're not there at your phone. I'm sorry. When you get on the phone and you're on hold, don't leave your phone. Because if you leave the phone, you won't be there when I call your name. I heard the radio in the background. It's, about a 30-second delay or more. We can't just hold on for you to find out that I'm calling your name. We've got to move on. A lot of people waiting. Let's talk to Michael from Santa Cruz, California. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call today, Steve. Much appreciated on a Friday afternoon. Quick thank you for your verse-by-verse explanation of the Bible on the Narrow Path app, a great service for people like me. And it allows me to be a cell phone student of the Bible. I have a good Bible app. I have a good Narrow Path app. I can read the Bible whenever and wherever I want, and I can get an explanation of it from Steve Gregg himself. So thank you for that. Really appreciate it. With respect to that, I have been become kind of a fan of Luke. Uh-huh. And I have some a question with respect to Luke because of something you said. And whenever somebody looks at Luke, of course, the first question that pops in the mind is, who was Theophilus?
Yeah.
And you offer in your verse-by-verse app an explanation that there are various ways of looking at it. But something you said while discussing, I think it was John, really called my attention to a different possibility. Yeah. And when you were discussing John, you somehow brought up the word theophany,
yeah,
which is what you said was is of God. When somebody says theophany, it means of God. So I got to thinking of the similarities between theophany and Theophilus, and got to wondering if Luke, in saying, addressing himself to Theophilus, was actually addressing everybody who has a relationship with God.
Okay.
In that connection, do you think that is a possibility?
Well, one of the theories about Theophilus is that it's referring to every lover of God. The word Theophilus means lover of God. Now, the similarity between that word and theophany is that both words have the word theos as their root. Theos is the Greek word for God. So in the New Testament, whenever you see the word God in the Greek New Testament, that's the word theos. Now, the word theos is joined with other particles in certain names and so forth, and different words. And theophany is from theos and phaneo. Phaneo means appearance. So theophany is theos phaneo, or an appearance of God. Theophilus is a lover of God. Philus or phileo means love, and so Theophilus means a lover of God. Now, that's why those words sound somewhat similar, because they both have theos as one of their particles in the word. So could Luke be addressing this to any lover of God? Well, that is one theory. I mean, of the many theories about who Theophilus is, it's thought by many, by some at least, that he's writing to the generic believer, to any Christian. He's called, O lover of God, because in Luke he says, I thought to write to you, Theophilus. O Theophilus. In Acts 1 he says, O Theophilus. And this could mean lover of God as a generic. However, there's a couple problems with that. I mean, there's certain things that would make other theories more likely than that. One is that Theophilus was actually a very common proper name in those days. That is, among Greeks, Theophilus was not so much used as a generic as it was an actual name. So, I mean, like the name Stephen, from the Greek word Stephanos. Stephanos means crowned. And if somebody wanted to address Christians as crowned ones, let's say they've been crowned with loving kindness and tender mercy, like it says in Psalm 103. So figuratively, we are the crowned ones. Well, he could call them Stephanos, which is the name Stephen, but that'd be very confusing since Stephen is actually an actual proper name. So it doesn't seem likely that he'd take that which is more commonly used as a proper name and use it as something that is not a proper name of an individual. But the other thing is this, that although he speaks to Theophilus in Acts chapter 1 as O Theophilus, in Luke chapter 1, when addressing Theophilus, he says, Most Excellent Theophilus. Now, Most Excellent is a term you find in addressing political officials. Political officials in the Roman Empire were called Most Excellent. Most Excellent Felix. Most Excellent Festus, or whatever. You know, Most Excellent was sort of like saying Your Honor or Your Majesty or some terms like that. And he says Most Excellent Theophilus, which makes most commentators believe that Theophilus is the name of somebody in a government office, which strikes me as probably a better explanation than making it generic. I appreciate your inquiry. It's certainly a reasonable one to ask. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or just go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend. Let's talk again Monday. God bless.